Week 14 was full of surprises, most notably the Cowboys finally lose again. Giants sweep the season series. Seahawks get outclassed in Lambeau. Broncos are on the brink, and the Dolphins win but lose Ryan Tannehill. Can they survive? All that and much more on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit. We are talking about Week 14, and interesting things happened, most notably the Dallas Cowboys lost. What do you think of this one, Andy? Was it a surprise to you that the Cowboys, well, finally lost another game in the regular season?
No, because the way they lost, it was all within context of the way both teams have been playing. And that's not to say the Cowboys were due for a loss or anything like that. But we talked last week, Gary, at length on the Thursday podcast going into this game about how well that Giants secondary has been playing. And yeah, they were great against Pittsburgh, and they were great in this one, and that's what really defined the game. So the Giants played the same way they've been playing for the last several weeks now.
Well, let's officially brand this. Topic number one.
Number one.
New York Giants sweep the Cowboys, dominating defensive performance. I guess we'll start with the Cowboys side of the ball, since they are the team that had only one loss coming into this one and still are the number one seed in the NFC. Were there any red flags you saw on the offensive side of the ball tonight for Dallas, or is it simply just a matter of a bad matchup?
I wouldn't call it a bad matchup necessarily. Anytime you face a secondary that can cover at all three positions, and that's what the Giants have right now, they're the best cornerbacking group in the NFC, you're going to get inherent matchup problems, because if you have guys that can cover everywhere, then you can do anything you want schematically with your other eight defenders, and that's what Steve Spagnuolo does. You saw all game long, he was blitzing out of different looks. They were checking in and out of blitzes based on what Dak Prescott did at the line of scrimmage. They went into three-man rushes on the final series when Prescott brought extra guys in to help pass protect. So they're a very versatile defense because they can trust their corners in one-on-one scenario, and that's exactly what they went out and got these guys for. That's why they paid Janoris Jenkins that money. That's why they drafted Eli Apple in the first round. They want to have that flexibility, and it fits Spagnuolo. So it's not a matchup thing per se specific to Dallas. It's just that's what the Giants can do when they're on top of their game. What needs to be examined closer, Gary, and it's something that takes time. You got to go back and look at it during the week, and this is true of the coaches, not just people watching like you and me watching, is why was Prescott holding the ball as long as he was? Was it strictly the coverage, or was he not seeing things as clearly? Because that has been a little bit of an issue the last few weeks. He has not seen the field quite as clearly as I think a lot of people would guess with him. And you hope that is not becoming a bigger issue, because that's bad timing if it is.
Well, I'll bring up two plays. And the first one is, this was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, my overall impression of what they do with Dak Prescott is they do not want him throwing the ball deep over the middle of the field. And I would guess from my Andy Benoit education, because they don't want him having to read the backside safety there. They don't want that to factor in. So if he's throwing deep, they want it, you know, they want it down a sideline, as opposed to that interception he threw to Dez Bryant that Leon Hall picked off. That's a ball where he didn't see Hall on the other side of the field, throws it to the middle. Dez Bryant is looking back thinking, well, there's no way this ball is coming to me, so why am I even trying to track it? And all of a sudden it falls in for an easy interception. Is that the kind of throw that you were – I was surprised to see him even attempt that throw.
That was uncharacteristic. Yeah, that was an undisciplined play. It was third and 15, and – what teams call it is middle field open and middle field closed. And if it middle field open, it means there's two safeties in the middle of the field. There's the gap between them. And if it's middle field closed, it's one safety and that guy's in the dead middle of the field. And receivers read that and run their routes accordingly. And I would almost guarantee you Dez Bryant saw middle field closed and knows, hey, per the rules of our playbook, that ball should not be thrown to me. It never will. It hasn't been all year long. And human nature got the best of him there. So that was an aberrational play almost, because that was, you're right, that was exactly what you're not supposed to do. And my sense is Prescott just pushed the issue thinking it's 3rd and 15 and this will be like a really long punt, which was not appropriate because they didn't have the punt coverage on, so to speak, with the other type of routes that accompanied that one.
Yep. The other play, there was it was the third down play at the end where Kennard actually knocked it down the line of scrimmage, but if he didn't knock it down, it looked like he was going to be hitting Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie between the 4 and the 1. It looked like Prescott just absolutely did not see him. And I don't know. I don't know if you noticed anything on that play. Obviously, it's tough to see with the broadcast angle before before we can see the coach's film.
Yeah, and that's why we hate to say, oh, well, late void for the film. I don't like to do that to our listeners, but that's what we're talking about on some of this stuff is you want to know, and that's why Jason Garrett and Scott Linehan, they're going to wait for this film because what you want to know is not so much how the play went, but what did he see or what did Prescott think he saw, and that's how you coach a guy. And so that's what we're getting here and talking about is, hey, what did he see on the play? And that's the genuine question, and they're going to get an answer to that, and then they're going to adjust accordingly. But the Giants will give you a lot of different looks, a lot of different fronts. Mm. And what stood out to me, Gary, what they did, they made Prescott play mentally fast by giving those fronts they did. And he had to move off his spot a number of times in the game. In fact, he moved off his spot and had to reposition and reset more often than he just had a straight drop back. He was constantly moving. He wasn't getting a clear picture, and he's a very good mover, but what he's best at overall is being patient and calm and poised. And so if you give him different blitz looks like they did and move him off the spot, you eliminate that factor from his game. Now he can't play calm and poised. He had to play reactionary, and he wasn't very good playing on the move in reactionary mode. So when he's in control and it's a design movement or it's improvised movement, but he's clearly going from one place to another. He's moving with purpose. He's a phenomenal quarterback. But when he had to move, it was very ambiguous movement tonight. When he had to do that, he looked wide-eyed and lost at times.
Yep. And I'd hate to get into another hypothetical, but we've talked about this matchup a couple of times. What happens if it is an NFC title game where Dallas hosts Seattle? And we like Seattle's matchup against the Dallas run game. I would just ask, Seattle sort of, if they sit back in that base cover 3, is that less problematic for Prescott based on what you saw tonight?
Well, and that's a good question, because now we're talking hypothetical. We're talking Seattle
very
as a concept. Yeah, so we're not breaking down the matchup, but the Giants had success with those corners locking up and playing man. Not that they play man-to-man all the time. They play both man and zone. Seattle, where they're different, or a team like Seattle, because the other team I think that is a contender in the NFC is Atlanta, and they play the same coverage as Seattle. You know what you're getting with them, at least. There's a predictability to it. So the stuff we're talking about with Prescott, and he's wide-eyed, and he wasn't comfortable, that would not be a factor against those kind of defenses. What is a factor is just trying to out-execute them. They're hard defenses to execute against, but mentally, a quarterback, in theory, should be pretty comfortable going up against those defenses, Seattle's, your Atlanta's, your cover 3, mm-hmm. basic cover 3 defenses, because you know the rules of cover 3, you know what you're going to get from them.
All right. Well, other side of the ball in the Sunday nighter, which was a really good game, very entertaining game, very tense defensive battle. Both defenses very good. Eli Manning is your winning quarterback in the same way that a winning pitcher might maybe pitch 5 innings and give up 14 runs, but win the game 16-14. Eli Manning not particularly sharp tonight. And
no,
I don't know if it's that time of year where the wind starts sort of affecting his deep ball, but he was having trouble just, I mean, boy, he almost threw a late interception that took the game right out of their hands.
The wind doesn't impact your ability to read very basic underneath linebackers in coverage. And there were two times tonight, and he got away both times with it, but they were horrendous plays, and it was just a coincidence he didn't get picked off, where he turned his back to the defense, and when he turned back around, he had no idea where the linebacker was. And maybe that seems understandable. Hey, he turned your back to the defense, but it was a quick play action. So the linebacker, it's reasonably expected the linebacker is going to be around where he was when you turned around in the first place, and they were all zone, basic zone coverages, so there was nothing to fool him, at least especially not on the one that Durant dropped. And Durant has had a few, he had another late fourth quarter interception opportunity against Washington, I believe, back in week two I think he didn't connect on that one. He nearly picked it off. But anyway, it was a bad performance by Manning. Certainly, the difference in the game, I thought there were two things, Gary. One, obviously, Odell Beckham and the play he made on the catch and run. And then the other thing is the Giants did get some sustainability from their rushing attack tonight. Their inside zone run game and their one back power. Basically, anything you can think of that's bland and up the middle, that's what they do in the run game. And they had a decent success with it. It kept them on schedule most of the night.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice little change. Yeah,
Perkins is the guy there now, right? Paul Perkins is going to be the guy down the stretch for them at running back.
Yeah, I don't know how much of an upgrade it is, but it is an upgrade over Rashad Jennings. I don't know why that's taken so long to happen. But yeah, that ball, I couldn't get over that ball that almost got picked. That near interception to Durant. He kept it low and away where only Durant could catch the ball, I guess.
Yep.
You could say that. But boy. Yeah, the Beckham play was phenomenal, obviously. And there's one, you know, he's so quick at the beginning of those, you know, those long catch and runs, but the way he sustains top speed is just, I mean, it's otherworldly. It's inhuman. Yeah. It's I don't know. I remember we met with, we did a little Super Bowl trip last year. We did a cross country thing with our staff, and we had stopped in Ohio and talked to Jim Tressel, and we talked about Ted Ginn with Jim Tressel in the lead up to the Super Bowl. And he said the one thing about Ted Ginn is because of all that track and field training he does, he can maintain top speed for so much longer than your typical football player can. And that's why you see him constantly outrunning people. And that's all I could think of with Odell tonight, because it looked like he was going to get tripped up for like 20 yards, and then he just got a little more separation, and then, you know, he's in the end zone.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point. That's a great point that Tressel made, and you're right on with equating that to Beckham. That's what he does. It has the effect of him getting faster as the play progresses, because
everyone else
cannot maintain that top speed.
Yep. Man, what do you think Ben McAdoo? What do you think Ben McAdoo was saying to his walkie-talkie to Eli after a couple of these throws?
I don't know, but my guess is he had something like he has a little word at the end of it to make it more fun, like Roger that or over, you know, like he's gonna make it a game. Eli, say over to give me the over signal back after I say you didn't say it. You didn't do the over signal.
You really should end every transmission with over. Over.
Yes.
No, I just love that. I love that Ben McAdoo had a walkie-talkie, and I'm sure he's going to go home and have some fun with his ham radio, and that's just Ben McAdoo's world right now.
Yep.
He's the coach of a 9-5
team. Baggy clothes, thin mustache, baggy clothes, and walkie-talkies.
Yep. Yep. Sorry, 9-4 team. I've already chalked up another loss. I'm sorry. Yeah, Giants, good shape. Good game. Really fun game. Really entertaining game to watch. Also flowed really nicely. I thought the official did a nice job with this one, too, sort of staying out of the way.
I agree with you. I thought it flowed very well. I thought that myself watching it.
Number two.
Well, let's go on to topic two, and this was the Packers. It was Green Bay week for the MMQB, so I'm not saying we were rooting for a Packers win, but we didn't want to see the Packers lose by 40 points at home to the Seahawks, and they did not. They won convincingly against a Seattle team that just didn't really show up today. I don't know how else to put it. You had a couple of interceptions just ricocheting off of receivers. One hit Doug Baldwin in the face mask, which, I mean, you never see that, and you certainly wouldn't expect to see it from a good player like Doug Baldwin, but I guess you chalk this one up to one of those days for Seattle, but This was another game where they were shaky on the road offensively, and we've talked about this offense, and I don't know, Andy, do you have any concern after seeing a game like this and seeing the game in Tampa? And I know we like what they do offensively and we think they're getting better, but when do you start to worry about this? Because they don't score many points on the road.
Well, then that's a problem with offense as a concept, right? That's going to be an issue.
Yeah.
They are, I don't want to say they're an offense looking for their identity. I think they know what it is, but what their identity is, it really has just come together lately. It's Thomas Rawls is now in there at running back, and he's a totally different type of runner than other yep. guys that they've had at the position. And then Russell Wilson is now mobile for the first time all year. And you're mixing this with Jimmy Graham, who's been there now, but he wasn't there this time last year. He'd been injured.
Yeah.
So this is really the first time he's been a full-fledged feature part of the offense. So those are three dynamic pieces, probably your three most important elements to the offensive design, and it's just now getting pieced together. So maybe you're going to see ups and downs like this. The other thing is Seattle's always had this a little bit, and I'm not criticizing Daryl Bevel when I say this. I think he's a good offensive coordinator, but they will go through bouts of just no rhythm in their play calling. It's like individual plays. One play does not correlate or lead to the next, and that's really not how they're built to play. They're a zone running team. They've got a QB that you do have to help through scheme a little bit because he's not tall in the pocket, so you can't just ask him to be a five-read drop-back yep. guy. You got to move him around. You got to help him out. He's phenomenal when you do. But they need to be a rhythmic offense, and they're really not that on a week-to-week basis. And it's ironic that we're saying that with them going against Green Bay, because that's the other thing with Green Bay is you don't know what you're going to get from them offensively each week, and it looks like this was a week where the Packers decided to play up to their potential on offense.
They did, but Aaron Rodgers, calf problems at the end of this one. I don't know if it's connected to the Monday nighter in Philadelphia. He had to go back into the tent. He had to go back into the tent, and I don't know if they tell scary ghost stories in there or what, but he didn't come back into the game. It was out of hand. They had a clinch. It was 28-3, but he didn't really play much in the fourth quarter. And the last series, he really did not look good coming off the field. So we'll have to keep an eye on that going forward.
You know what? I don't wish for any guy to be hurt or certainly in pain or anything like that, but the Russell Wilson thing from earlier this year where his leg injury, his ankle injury, I think it was, some knee stuff perhaps, it made him more of a disciplined pocket passer, and I think that helps him in the long haul. That Rodgers being forced to stay still, because I assume that's what would happen if he has a calf. That's what happened last time when he had the calf injury a few years ago in the playoffs. That would not be the worst thing in the world for him. Maybe some instilled, forced discipline. That might not be. I know they played great today, and I know he was great 2 weeks ago against Green Bay, but these were on schedule plays, especially 2 weeks ago against, I said, Green Bay. I mean, Philadelphia. Those were on schedule plays that he's playing well with. The improvised runaround sandlot Aaron Rodgers, that's the guy who's been inconsistent and who really doesn't fit the offense right now as well. The offense doesn't fit him. So this could be a blessing in disguise is all I'm saying. Have him play from the pocket more.
I'll buy that. And just a quick note, Seahawks home versus road offensively here. 28.7 points at home. They have 6 turnovers in 5 games. Go on the road, 14.5 points per game with 11 turnovers over 7 games. So that's those are splits. Those are home-road splits.
Mm.
And they're going to have to go on the road at some point because they will not have the number one seed. They probably will win the NFC West regardless, though, because we'll talk about that Cardinals loss a little bit later. But right now,
number 3,
Denver Broncos go out to Tennessee, get Trevor Siemian back, and they just don't have enough. This was the Titans winning in a very Titans type of way. Lots of runs, lots of defense, and Tennessee gets the win 13-10. And I guess the question now is, Broncos sit at 8-5, and I know you don't want to project and do the math and all that stuff, but I would simply ask, Andy, is this team in trouble? Are they going to be able to generate enough offense down the stretch to win 2 or 3 more games?
Well, their offense seems to be getting worse. We're just watching them on film and watching what they're trying to do and who they're trying to be. And their running game has not come to fruition yet. And that's a problem because Trevor Siemian, who I think is a better player now than he was early in the season or even at the halfway point, he's not a guy you want having him drop back. And this game is 51 times for him he dropped back, 54 if you count the sacks.
54 with the sacks, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want that with Trevor Siemian. That's not how they're built to play. So they have
if you saw the 54 dropbacks, I'm guessing you saw the rushing attempts as well for Denver.
Well, and they had 9 of them for 18 yards. I know they were down 2 scores for much of the game, but that's too extreme. And some of these first down passes that they've been doing that we've talked about, they did it with Paxton Lynch last week. They're very aggressive with first down passes. So is Tennessee, by the way, and that's what's really helped Tennessee's offense. But it has made – Denver's been inconsistent with that this season. So the problem is they're missing Andy Janovich now, their fullback, and so much of their running game is built around having the fullback in there and having two back sets and lead blocks, and they lose that dimension. So they have to almost redefine some of their running game at a time when it's not clicking very well. But anytime you go on the road or at home, doesn't matter. Anytime you play a team that has their quarterback 6 of 20 throwing against you, Gary, which is what Marcus Mariota was in this game, and you lose that game, then, yeah, there's something wrong. There's something that has to be evaluated there. That's a bad showing.
Yep. Well, this was a nice win for the Titans, but we will highlight one play from this game. As a matter of fact, it was a low light. Away from the play, Harry Douglas takes a little dive at Chris Harris's knee, causes a big scuffle. Aqib Talib went after Douglas on the next play, and this was dirty. I mean, this was a dirty play. What did you think of this, Andy?
I'm not going to condone Talib going after Douglas, and I need to look at that closer. I saw the Douglas play, and I like that Talib would go after him. I hope he would do it within the rules, just like Douglas technically did what he did within the rules, going low at Chris Harris in open field, cut blocking him in an area of the field where really the only time you really need to cut block a guy is if you're trying to get him down at the line of scrimmage so you can throw over him. And otherwise, it's not appropriate to cut block, but the rules say you can. I thought it was a little arrogant of Douglas to say, well, Chris Harris doesn't watch film, otherwise he'd know I cut block in the field. That's how I block. Harry Douglas hasn't been on film a whole lot this year. He's not a player. He's a number 4, number 5 receiver, and he went out there and he did a cheap block that's technically within the rules, so I'm not going to call it dirty. But the NFL, I would hope, would just clean that up and rectify it, because it's a pointless risk to put at any guy's legs for that kind of a play. There's no upside for cut blocking, so why allow it to be in the rule book then?
Yeah. And look, I've said I think the league, I think officials, but hey, officials are going to miss some stuff during the game. I think the league should really come down on these. It's a player safety issue at this point, and it's a completely unnecessary play. I know it is technically legal, but it's the same thing, you know, Burfict last year, the half dozen times when he wrenches a guy's ankle when he's on the floor, when he cheap shots someone when the ball is thrown to the other side of the field where he, you know, basically decleats someone who's doesn't have a pass coming their way. I mean, this is... It's legal. It's technically legal, but it's unnecessary, and it should fall under the heading of unnecessary roughness, and it should draw. I think it should draw suspensions. I think you just move past fines with this stuff if you're really going to be serious about player safety, which the league, you know, says it is, and they've done some nice stuff with the concussion stuff, and I'm not going to jump down their throats for everything, but I think they got to be better with this stuff. I think you need a harsher deterrent for what's going on.
Because it propagates more violence. Talib went after him the next play, and if you're Denver's secondary coach or Gary Kubiak or anyone on that team, you're not scolding Talib for that. You're not scolding them. So now we're talking about building violence on top of violence and players policing themselves, and you don't want that. You don't want inmates running the facility.
Yep. Yeah, I would love to see Harry Douglas suspended for a game. I know he won't be. I would guess he'd get a minimal fine. And that's kind of the precedent that has been set.
It is. I will say it is a fine line, because the last time we had this kind of conversation, it was the Jarvis Landry block on Aaron Williams, which unfortunately had very bad repercussions for Aaron Williams. And when I watched the film of that, because you had said you were saying Jarvis Landry ought to be suspended, I watched the film and I thought, you know what, that's a perfectly legal block. And my gosh, that was way too violent. I don't know what you do about that. I don't believe he was even fined for that one, was he?
That's actually a really good question. I will say, I can't remember what I said on the podcast.
You know what, I'm wrong. I'm sorry, he was fined $24,000.
Okay.
So he was fined considerably. He wasn't
penalized at the
time. I backed off
the call for a suspension. I think a fine was in order. I think a penalty was in order. Anytime you basically leave your feet and contact a guy's head like that. Landry in that case contacted chest, if I remember correctly.
Right, that's what I thought. I didn't think, and look, I'm wrong here, because they find them and they have people that played the game and watched this stuff closely, and it's their job, and so they determined it was a wrong hit. But I remember watching the film when that Landry hit on Williams and saying that is horrendously violent, but it felt to me within the context of reasonableness that it was part of the game, that he made a block.
I thought the Douglas play was more egregious.
Because the Landry one, he was blocking as part of the run equation. His responsibility was to go get the safety out of that run hole. And maybe Douglas technically had Chris Harris, but it was in the open field where Douglas did it. And he didn't need to make that type of block in that area of the field.
Yeah. Well, all right. Andy, before we jump ahead to topic four, just a quick note, a reminder in case some of you have somehow missed it. The 10 Things Look Ahead podcast is out every Thursday. That's when Andy and I preview our favorite games for the upcoming week. It's a look at the future. That's also when we do our mailbag. We don't do it in this show anymore. We used to do two or three questions on the Look Ahead podcast. We do a giant mailbag. We will get to as many questions as humanly possible, not just the two or three we used to do here. So send your questions, tweet at Andy_Benoit or at gramling_si. Get either of us on Facebook, or you can email talkback@themmqb.com. If you put podcast in the subject line, it is more likely to be seen.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out Open Floor with Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver.
The weird thing watching that game was that the Clippers were trying to play like the Warriors. We talked about how the Clippers could give this team a run for their money because they could score inside on them, but the Warriors did a great job forcing the Clippers into a bunch of pull-up threes, and if that happens, like, it's not even going to be close.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of Open Floor wherever you download your shows.
Number four.
On to topic four. And this is the Dolphins win, but Ryan Tannehill goes down. It sounds like, as we tape right now, ACL is the rumor. Matt Moore, he's been there for a while. He's been a suitable backup for a long time. What is the drop-off, especially considering this has obviously been the Jay Ajayi show down in Miami this year?
Well, it has. It was for a while. I think Tannehill's kind of carried that offense most of the last month or so, though. He's played very well when that running game has not been getting going. Tannehill's not a top-shelf superstar, but they're going to miss him. Any team will miss their quarterback. Any 8-5 team especially is going to miss their quarterback. You're playing them at this stage of the season, late into the season. Adam Gase has worked in this kind of scenario before. He's worked with other guys mid-year. Matt Moore's been there a long time. So we ought to expect business as usual. It's hard. That's a tall order. Maybe it's unfair, but that's the NFL for you.
Yeah, this was a game played in a lot of torrential downpour, sort of on and off raining, very Miami weather down there. And this was another game that the Cardinals lost with shaky special teams. Missed extra point, a missed field goal, and they end up losing it on the late field goal. And that late field goal drive that I guess you give Moore the credit for the game-winning drive on this one. He did find Kenny Stills on kind of an oddly lofted ball, sort of taking advantage of, the Cardinals' two weaknesses, special teams and any cornerback not named Patrick Peterson for the most part. And this was, you know, a ball lobbed in Kenny Still's general direction. Justin Bethel couldn't find it, and that ends up putting Miami inside the five and setting up that game-winning kick.
It's too bad with Bethel because he had that issue last season, and his coverage in that Packers playoff game when Janis, especially on the 4th and 20 play, a lot of people talked about the Hail Mary aspect of the Janis 4th and 20 play. I can assure you Cardinals coaches saw it as a pathetic coverage breakdown on that play. So Bethel's had a few issues before, but I thought he's looked good this year when thrown into the lineup. They haven't kept him there. He's only been there by necessity, so yeah. They don't feel totally comfortable with him, but the point is I feel bad that we're talking about Justin Bethel negatively on the first time on the podcast this year, because the times he's been in there he's looked good, but you're right, that is a spot of concern for this defense, and it's been that way. Marcus Cooper's done a nice job for the most part, but it's been that way at important times this season, let's put it like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, this almost had a very bizarre ending to regulation. There were 10 seconds left. The Dolphins had it at the 3, and presumably they were just going to, you know, set it up for the short chip shot, even though there was rain, so maybe they were going to try and punch it in the end zone. But they handed it to Damian Williams, who sort of spun back around and backed it up and then sort of surged forward, and they almost ran out of time. Clock almost expired. There's 1 second left. If the Cardinals had done the old, I remember the Ravens did this to the Bills about 6 or 7 years ago, where they were trying to strip a ball late and force a turnover, and I can't remember who the Bills' tight end was at the time, but they had him and they held him and they sort of slowly marched him forward as everyone hacked at the ball until it finally came out because his forward progress wasn't stopped.
Mm-hmm.
They never blew it dead, so.
Those Ravens are good at that end of game stuff. That's a team where I would love John Harbaugh to like do my taxes or something for me, because he knows every loophole, and he does it the right way. They do it within the proper protocol.
You could write off your ham radio that you talked to Ben McAdoo on. John Harbaugh would make that happen. The other thing I wanted to mention, and again, you can count up 3 games that the Cardinals have given up clearly on special teams mishaps. The opener, the Seattle game, and this one. So this could be 8-5 team if things hadn't gone so wrong on special teams.
I gotta back you off on that. Special teams, yeah, they've had some games, some issues there. This offense on Arizona is not what it was a year ago. The offensive line's been very poor. Guys that were good last season, namely Mike Iupati at left guard, have had a number of mental and physical breakdowns. And then Carson Palmer, maybe because of that, not strictly because of that, though, it has not been the same quarterback either. And the other guy, Michael Floyd, is not the same guy. So several key players for Arizona have just played worse, and it's been worse within the context of what they do. They're doing the same plays as last season, just worse. So it's been a bad year for Arizona. I don't know if you blow it up. They're going to be an interesting team offseason-wise for the discussion there, because what do you do about Palmer? Yes, what do you do? And I think I would roll with them again. I think they will. But this has been a weird season to see a team just be bad in areas where they were good the previous year. And you're right, special teams has been a factor, but it's an underachieving team.
Yeah, I'm not saying they're not underachieving. I'm just saying you could pinpoint individual special teams plays that they couldn't convert that should be fairly routine that would make them an 8-5 team. That's all. Jermaine Gresham also had probably the most asinine taunting penalty of the year that probably cost some points in the third quarter, and I don't know why they still run him out there. Are they out of tight ends? I don't know why they keep on playing the guy.
Well, they ask – their system's not an easy one to learn, and some of the other tight ends that they've had in, Troy Nicholas hasn't always been healthy. When he's been healthy, they haven't been comfortable with him out there. Gresham's a guy. Darren Fells is all right, but he's more of a role player type of tight end. He's not dimensional. He's not particularly big. So Gresham, just I think they're most comfortable with him. And it's a 2 tight end offense. That's the other thing. All offenses are 3 receiver offenses. We know that, but they do a lot out of 2 tight end sets, and almost always they align those tight ends on the same side of the formation. And so Gresham's a guy they're comfortable doing that with. I know this, when Gresham was in Cincinnati and his contract expired, I don't think there was very much consideration at all about resigning him. I think they were glad to let him him go. Not because they don't like him personally, because kind of just some of the stuff you've talked about, he's a little bit mistake prone. He'd make a great New York Giant tight end. He's got that same kind of issue. Right when you think they're good, they do something horrible.
Yeah. Well, his taunting penalty was horrible. After a 2-yard gain, they picked up. They finally, Cardinals couldn't get anything going. They get a punt fumble. Landry coughed up a punt. They get it at midfield, catch a break, and they get set right back as Gresham taunts after a 2-yard run. Anyways, last thing I wanted to mention about that game. With Tannehill out, the Saturday nighter. Cancel your Saturday night plans because it's going to be Matt Moore versus Bryce Petty. National stage Saturday night. That's when to, I don't know, read the box score on Sunday morning.
I'll be flying back from New York for our SI meetings that night, but I did set the DVR for that game tonight, so maybe it'll be waiting for me when I get off the flight.
There you go. That's,
or maybe I'll fire up the coach's film and see the stuff I miss all week because I'm doing these meetings we have.
And that'll be a holiday treat for you when you get back, Andy.
Number 5.
Topic number 5. Let's go on to Matthew Stafford. Does it again in the fourth quarter. Maybe does it again for the first 3.5 quarters. But he ends up pulling this one out with the run. He trucks Eric Ebron in the end zone for the game-winning touchdown run. They squeak one out at home against the Bears, the Matt Barkley-led Bears. Andy, your Extra Point article this morning is about Stafford and his candidacy for MVP, which if you are not going to vote for Tom Brady because of the suspension, and many people will not, Matthew Stafford might be the guy at this point.
That would be my guy. And it's partly him. I think he's had a nice season. This one he had to come back. He came back because he threw a horrible interception on an Anquan Boldin slot out route early in the mid fourth quarter, about 6.5 minutes left, I believe. He was inaccurate on a ball that he really shouldn't have thrown anyway. So he put himself in a hole, but he came out of the hole as he's done all season long. But that's not necessarily why he's MVP. I think he's done. That's a factor, of course, but I think he's done more with less than any QB in the league. When you look at his supporting cast, the nature of that offense and what they ask him to do, he's more of a field general. We've talked about Stafford, and we've talked about how he's had to grow with Calvin Johnson gone, and it's been a blessing in disguise because he's had to become a more disciplined player, and it's worked for him. But Gary, the other reason I have him as MVP, I don't think there are a lot of good MVP candidates this year. I think there are a lot of flawed candidates at the top of the list.
Yeah, it's very MVP by default, almost.
Yeah.
Two sweetest words in the English language, default. And that's kind of where we are with the MVP race right now.
Because the guys, let's run through it real quick. We're not going to spend all this time on it, but a lot of people are suggesting the rookies in Dallas. I think the three most valuable players on that offense are the offensive linemen that everybody likes.
Yep.
Probably Frederick, Smith, and Martin in that order. Pick any order you want, though. Derek Carr, people know how I feel about that. He's played much better the last month. Fundamentally, he's been a better QB. He had a bad game against Kansas City, but he has been a better quarterback. But MVP's a season-long award, and I still think some of the unevenness, it's hard to shake that. And same thing with Matt Ryan. He's been, to me, a slightly better version of Carr this year. But Julio Jones is more valuable to that Falcons offense than Ryan has been, you could argue. You could at least have the discussion. So, and who else would you pick? Who else is in the conversation for MVP after that? Unless we turn to defense, which I would be all for, but I don't think people don't do that. So it's almost academic to stress that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, you'd kind of start talking Khalil Mack, but, you know, I don't know if you can.
I think you go Vaughn Miller
goodness,
before Mack.
Yeah, I mean, with the points the Raiders have given up, you know, I don't know if he can give MVP to the guy on that unit.
I think it's Von Miller, Khalil Mack is the only candidates there.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I had to have a second vote, I'd like to vote Brady, but I get that people probably don't want to do that because of suspension. That's a hard one. What do you do about that? But let's say Brady's eliminated for that. I go Stafford 1, Von Miller 2.
I could go with that. I wrote this morning that, I mean, all this talk of like, oh, the Cowboys offensive line, and we agree it's absurd to award it to a group. There are Lombardi trophies that go to entire teams, so that's how you honor group achievement. I say if you're going to look at the Cowboys offensive line, just break out Travis Frederick. Because you have to take Smith out. If you're taking Brady out of the equation because he missed four games, you have to take Smith out because he missed two games. Mm-hmm. And then you're talking about basically Frederick versus Martin. You know, Frederick's the center. He's got a little more responsibility and
yep.
And whatever,
within the context of
Martin
that,
too,
yeah, that scheme asks more of its center than its guard. So, yes, Frederick, yeah. Frederick would be more valuable by definition. It's not a great – it's a good year for All-Pro and Pro Bowl stuff because I think there are a lot of guys playing well at a lot of positions. It's been good football. But the very top of the league this year, there hasn't been – I think the top five or six MVP candidates of last year would all get it this year, just apples to apples.
Yep. Well, before we wrap up Bears Lions, one more thing about this game: the Bears they had back to back holding penalties, and they were like we talked about either it was either the Thursday show or the week before that. I mean,
yeah.
There were holding penalties that prevented sacks, so it wasn't like illegal formation or something like that. But yeah, the Bears moved into field goal range twice at the end, and they both got called back by holding penalties. So.
Yeah, but
that's
you're
just
right.
The way it goes.
They only got the completions only happened because of the holds.
Exactly.
So you're right. And
exactly.
they were pass rush issues that came to roost. Leno got beat on an outside speed rush. And then at right guard, Ted Larson, I believe it's Larson, got beat on a stunt, a very basic
yep.
stunt. That Detroit, and that's Detroit does a lot with stunts. They're good at that, and that's what they do. And that got them in the most critical moments. It beat the Bears.
Yeah,
you really ought to credit the defense for that. We talk about holding penalties. They're drawn holds. The defense
yes.
drew it. It's as good as a sack in a lot of cases, and that's what they did. Devin Taylor is the guy that got the second holding foul on the stunt, and it was good defense.
Yep. Well, Bears lose. Matt Barkley. I'm glad Matt Barkley is playing well. I wonder what kind of player he would be had he not had the shoulder troubles at USC that sort of sapped his arm strength, but glad to see him playing well. Can I tell you a really quick Matt Barkley story?
Of course.
So when I was at SI Kids, we put him on the cover before his freshman year at USC. He's the top quarterback recruit in the nation. So he was on the cover of like one of our summer issues or something like that, like our July issue. We had him in the USC uniform. It was all good, very exciting. And so we have the customer service email account where people usually write in. It's usually grandparents writing in saying, I want to know how to get the magazine for my granddaughter. How can yep. I send you, this jar of quarters to pay for a subscription and stuff like that. And one day we get an email in there and it's hello, my name is Matt Barkley and I'm on the cover of your July issue. Would it be possible to send me a copy of it? Thank you so much. Sincerely, Matt
wow.
Barkley. It was the most politely worded, just very, very
him?
Sweet email
sure?
that he sent.
Was it really
it was like,
him?
What a nice boy that Matt Barkley is.
Was it really him?
It was really him. Yeah, he was writing into customer service to say, and let this be a lesson to all of you out there. If you're ever on the cover of a national magazine, you can just ask to be comped a copy of that issue. You don't have to go out and, like, spend the money on her or anything.
Well,
so.
I would disagree because I've never been on the cover of SI, but I did have an SI story earlier this year that had my name on the cover, and my grandparents wanted it. And I asked you, in fact, Gary, you specifically, to send me a few copies, and you told me you couldn't because Robert Klemko had them all.
Robert Klemko had
Robert
them all.
Klemko.
I didn't even get a copy. I have one copy of that magazine. It's the one that the day after we closed, when I hadn't slept in basically 72 hours, I just sort of crammed it into my bag and left. So it's a crumpled up copy of the time I was managing editor of Sports Illustrated for a couple weeks. And I don't even have a copy of
that. You need to get one for yourself. Because
I was
going to
say, not that
job.
Anyone knows I worked on it because my name's like...
But you know, and we know, and you did the MMQB issue with Khalil Mack on the cover. I had the Gronkowski story. He politely pulled his hamstring, and that moved me out of the order.
Yep.
And Klemko snuck in there, and he had a great story on Khalil Mack and Jadeveon Clowney, and his grandmother's a big Raider fan, so he probably gave her 10,000 copies, and you and I were left with nothing, but I would hope you'd get one for yourself. And then my grandparents are at the age where buying their Christmas presents is just a hassle. It's what Hickory Farms do I pick out because they don't you can't get them anything. So if you could send me some copies, that would help me out a lot.
Well, when you're in the office this week, swing by and we'll see. I don't even know where storage is in the new. That's the other problem. I don't know where all the little tricks of the trade, all the corners where we keep all the good stuff. I don't know where it is in the new office because we got a new office last year. I'm just not there enough.
But. All right. Well, I'll be by. We'll figure it out.
All right.
Number six.
With that, let's move on to topic six. And this is the Falcons blowing out the Rams. Andy, I mean, we got to ask about Jared Goff. It's a terrible team surrounding him. It's a bad line. It's bad receivers. I mean, you know, this one sort of, well, it sort of fell apart on the opening kickoff when Michael Thomas, you don't see this very often, managed to literally kick the ball into the field of play, then couldn't recover it. So the Falcons recovered on the 3-yard line and scored in the first play from scrimmage, and that was
it was that kind of game. Yep.
Yeah, that was it. And next drive, Rams drove down, and Goff hits Kenny Britt in the numbers, and it bounced off his shoulder pad and turns into an INT, and it was awful after that. But I do want to ask you, how did Jared Goff look independent of the awfulness surrounding him?
He's looked like, and I've seen every one of his snaps this season, so he's looked like what you would expect a rookie who had to sit out and then joined a bad team late in the year. He's looked like what you'd guess from that. The encouraging signs, in his first game against Miami, the offense was what a high school offense looks like at the end of August when they opened the season up.
Yeah.
It was very basic, which tells you how the coaches felt about Goff. They weren't completely sure. But his next game out, his next outing, they had opened things up, not considerably, but they clearly had opened up a lot more. So that, which I took as a very positive sign, they felt a lot more comfortable with him. That was the Saints game, and he responded pretty well with that. He did have a bad interception on a predetermined throw underneath in that Saints game, and the only reason I mentioned that is because he had another one today to Deion Jones that actually turned out to be a pick six. Yep. So he's had the rookie mistakes. And the other thing is people have blitzed him a lot. Atlanta didn't do it quite as much. Maybe they felt they didn't have to. It's not in their nature either. But even New England, who doesn't blitz a lot, and Goff had even told the announcers in the days before the game, like, well, I catch a little bit of a break this week. I'm not going to see blitzes from these guys like I did the Saints and the Dolphins. He did see blitzes from those guys. And Bill Belichick did it because he believes Goff has a tendency to look at the pass rush when it's presented to him. And that's a very bad trait and something that must be overcome and grown out of as soon as possible.
And that's a problem. I don't know what's going on there as much as the Rams coaching staff does, but I would not have put him out there at all this year behind that offensive line. And I know we talked about it. He got crushed at Cal as a freshman, and obviously he came out okay after that, but I would not have chanced it with him, especially I think once the season is lost, I just think there's nothing to gain by throwing him out there other than saying, hey, look at our shiny new quarterback. And
right. Well,
look at him get crushed and look at him get intercepted, and isn't everyone excited about Rams football now?
The one thing you do get to gain, at least he's getting the preparation during the week. So you can give him all of the reps and practice, and he's going to be the guy in the meeting, and he has to – not that – I'm sure he was game planning hard before and learning stuff, but it's got to have a different energy when you are the starting quarterback. So at least he's getting the preparation down. But it's a bad situation in Los Angeles. Goff hasn't gotten the help either, like you said. The Britt drop interception is a great illustration of that. So Goff's been fine overall. His consistency and accuracy needs to sharpen, and he needs to read the field better with time and experience. I would expect that would be the case.
He also, I mean, he got nailed at that read on the read option touchdown at the end of the game. It's like, why is he running the ball at that point? They can't do anything right there.
It's a tough year for them, but they get to go on national TV at a really hard place to play on Thursday and let everybody see how they're doing.
They always beat the Seahawks.
They do. They
match
up well to that team.
30 points on Thursday night. And
it's because what they do have in Los Angeles is a defensive line and a penetrating one at that. And that will wreck a lot of teams, especially teams that don't have a very good interior offensive line, which has been Seattle's issue for a while.
Mm-hmm. And before we move on, we should mention Falcons, no Julio Jones today. Obviously, they did not need him. Honestly, nope. I don't think they even need to replace him. They could have just played 10 on offense and still won this one by two touchdowns. But they went at 42-14. It was not a competitive game.
Nope, Mohamed Sanu was out as well. So they were really thin at receiver, and Nick Williams was the guy that got to be the one nobody's heard of who got called up. And he's actually played in past years too, and he had a nice game for them. They like him with they feel he can do everything they ask him to do, as long as they don't ask him to be Julio Jones.
And I should mention at the top of this segment, it was Mike Thomas who botched the opening kickoff, not Michael Thomas. There are two Michael Thomases. One's the star receiver for the Saints. The other is a star special teams guy for the Dolphins. And this Mike Thomas, giving up really good field position to start games.
Your Dolphins guy, by the way, has been playing, I believe it's in the passing downs. It's either passing or run downs.
He's good. He's a good player.
He's all right. Yeah, he rotates in at safety. He rotates with Rambo. But, now that we're on the topic of Michael Thomas, because I feel like I type all these guys in my notes still. So anytime you do it, I feel like, oh, I know that guy. I need to say something.
Yeah.
Those are the Michael. Yeah. And people know the Saints' Michael Thomas. He's a good mechanized route runner. He's not explosive, but he can be a fundamentally sound route runner there for the Saints, which is what they need. That's what they got him for.
Number 7.
All right. Le'Veon Bell, huge day in Buffalo in the snow, 236 yards. That is a Steelers franchise record. And he added 62 more yards in the air. So, I don't know, anyone in fantasy playoffs, all you people asking me about Le'Veon Bell and saying, is Le'Veon Bell going to be enough? Yeah, he was enough because he had 298 yards and a bunch of touchdowns, too. This was all about Le'Veon Bell today. So, it doesn't beg the question, but I'm just going to follow it up with a question. This Steelers offense, taking on a slightly different identity the last 2 weeks, very, very run-heavy, not so much with a deep throwing, though they got one early to Antonio Brown, but does that make them a little better equipped for the postseason? Does it not really matter? Because you figure they're going to have to go to New England at some point if they're going to get to the Super Bowl.
Well, it does matter, because if you're going to play a team like New England, you want to be able to run the ball and control the clock and control the game, and that's what they've been able to do. Buffalo's run defense has been very good most of the last month or so. Not a lot of teams have run successfully against that defensive line, so that's a real feather in the cap, and that they're building the ground game this well late in the season. You wonder about giving Bell 38 rushing attempts in a game, but fine. All right. They did it. They gave him two games worth of rushing attempts, but they got two really
fresh
legs.
Missed those games early on.
That's the advantage. The other thing that's weird about this, Gary, is 3 years ago this week, that was the week where there were multiple snow games in the NFL. And the snowiest one was, it was so snowy, you couldn't watch it, especially on film, was the the Eagles and the Lions game. And remember, LeSean McCoy went crazy in that game and wound up with a bunch of yards rushing. And I actually did wind up watching because I watched it with him when we went to Buffalo later. But I wonder if there's something about being an agile runner in snow that gives you a huge advantage, because you'd think snow, you think pounding the rock, old school 1975 football when I don't know if it snowed more back then, but it felt like it's more of a north-south running game. But the guys that have had the huge numbers are McCoy and Le'Veon Bell, who are not those type of runners at all.
I mean, it was the type of game where very typical Le'Veon Bell, a lot of, wait that second or two behind the line of scrimmage, play a little peekaboo, pop out, and, you're 8 yards downfield before anyone's got a good hold on you, so.
Yeah, well, the longer you wait, and maybe it's this simple, the longer you wait, the more chance there is for the defense to slip in the snow. The longer a play happens, the more chance something goes wrong. That's just, and some coaches build their offense on that idea, which is why they don't like to run outside, because they think chances something going wrong increase, because they do. But that's true of the defense as well. And the defense in the snow has to react to you. So the chance of them having something go wrong is much greater, because they're not in the same kind of control of their movements as you are. Snow, it seems like it would favor the defense because it's hard to coordinate in snow, but snow favors the offense as long as you just have to call the right kind of plays to be safe with what you're doing with the ball, and running the ball is a good way to do that.
Yeah. And listen, other side of the field, other sideline in this game, report that Rex Ryan, again, we are taping this on Sunday night, Jason LaConfora reports that Rex Ryan in jeopardy of losing his job as soon as Monday morning. So maybe we'll wake up and Rex will be done. If it happens, we'll talk about it in depth on the Thursday show. I'm on record as just saying it is absurd, the expectations put on Rex Ryan and that staff this season, considering the roster, considering the quarterback, considering the fact that they basically went in with a scotch tape defense and that they've won six games, I think is an accomplishment with what they've been handed this year. But
I'm on your side with that. I would not fire Rex Ryan.
Number eight.
All right, on to topic eight. This was the, well, we'll call it the temporary AFC South championship game, even though the Titans are still tied for first. But this was the Texans topping the Colts, going very, very run heavy. But to me, this one was more about the Colts and just, boy, I don't know if they were just, you know, sleepwalking, coming off that Monday nighter with the Jets where they didn't really have to play. But this was a failure on basically every level of the organization. You had the players performing really poorly. You know, they had a goal line. They had a goal line situation where they had the ball at the two, second down and goal. Hand it to Gore, you know, with the big lineup in there, and he loses the yard. So now they're at the three, and they decide they're going to spread it out. They're going to take Gore out of the game. It's four down territory because they're down 6 points in the second half. And Luck on a play where the ball had to come out quickly. I don't know how else you'd possibly design this because they had Dwayne Allen trying to block Jadeveon Clowney and Robert Turbin basically as the only guy on the blind side picking up any blitzers, and there was a blitz coming. Luck pats the ball a couple times. Clowney gets in there, sheds Allen easily, gets the strip sack, and that was basically the end of it for the Colts. They also had a weird fourth down play at the end where I don't think it was a design screen, but it looked like a little sort of broken play dump off to Turbin that went horribly on fourth and one. And maybe you just put Frank Gore in the game. Maybe you give the ball to Frank Gore on fourth and one. But that's just me. But I thought it was a failure by the players, by the coaches, and by the by the front office guys who put this roster together. Philip Dorsett had a couple of terrible drops in this one. That's my Colts rant for now.
Yeah, that
I mean,
is
Dorsett. We don't have to go
ranty.
Back and go over the Dorsett draft when they had a million other needs and added another speedy, small wide receiver who just isn't performing up to expectations. But
all right, well, boy, that is
that was a rant.
Other than that, how'd you like the game?
It was all right. The Texans, I mean, look, the Texans did everything right. Texans just kept it on the ground and sort of waited for the Colts to gack this one away, kind of like they did the first time these teams met, though it was a little bit in the opposite in that the Texans had to come back in Indy early in the year. But
Texans have a good defense. It's not one that people talk about, but it's up there with all the top defenses in the NFL. And what they do so well, they disguise their coverages really well.
Yep.
And then they have guys that can pressure the QB, and I think Jadeveon Clowney is one of those guys. I think he's a all-around talented, impactful player now. I had him mid-season at first-team All-Pro. He's had that kind of year in my mind.
Yep.
But when they can disguise their coverages because they play this cover four, this split safety stuff where each of the back-level defenders has a fourth of the field. So outside corners each have a fourth along the boundaries, and then the safeties have the two remaining one-fourths in the middle of the field, and that's a lot of help coverage principles that you have to do. You got to really be on the same page and well coached, and they are there in Tennessee on that side. But when you play cover four, everyone starts out equally. It's four defenders across the field, so your safeties are even and lined up. We talked about, remember, with the Dez Bryant play, middle field open versus middle field closed. If you're cover four, you can rotate to either of those coverages very easily. You can rotate to any coverage easily because everyone lines up square to each other at the back end. So they're a hard defense to play against because they present you with different coverage looks. And Luck can handle that stuff, but that presents complications for receivers that have to read the field on the fly. It does make you hold the ball longer. That's the nature of Indy's offense a little bit too. Whoever faces Houston in the playoffs, if they get to the playoffs, that's not a game they're going to want to play because this team is better than its collective talent on defense.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, that's what won the game. It was You know, the Texans secondary beat the Colts receivers constantly. And, you know, this was a game where 48 dropbacks for Andrew Luck and 15 rushing attempts. And something had to change because it just wasn't working the way the Colts game plan for this one. So, but like I said, it was nice that it was a team effort by the Colts to figure out a way to lose this division when you have Andrew Luck playing as well as pretty much anyone in the league that's not Tom Brady. That's it, Andy. That's my Colts negativity.
Number 9.
Topic 9, the lightning is round. Do you want to open this up, Andy, or should I?
You go ahead and open it.
Okay, well, let's start with the Chargers and the Panthers. And this was a nice win for the Panthers. Didn't really know what they were going to be off of Tiegate. Everyone apparently wore their formal attire pregame because Derek Anderson only stepped in for one play and it was like middle of the game when Cam went down for a little bit. But Kurt Coleman was back, and I think that sort of solidified stuff in the Carolina secondary. This was a bad day for Phillip Rivers, bunch of turnovers, but Panthers defense also just played well. And one other note in this game, Kelvin Benjamin, they got to sit him down. He is a mess out there. He is costing them so many plays, and it's time for him
harsh.
To just watch from the sideline for a little bit.
That's
great
harsh. That's
physical
harsh.
Talent,
that's harsh.
And yeah.
That's harsh for Benjamin. You got to sit him down. That's harsh.
Yeah, have him watch from the sideline. He's just not getting it right now. And it's not necessarily an effort thing. I think he just doesn't know what to do out there. It reminds me of watching Kevin White for the Bears early in the season. That's what he reminds me of right now. And well, the season's done, so just put him on the sideline for a game. Say, hey, take it in. And, you know, something's got to change with him, though.
Kurt Coleman being back in the lineup helps a lot. That was a different-looking secondary without him. He plays free safety and strong safety, and they're weak at those other positions. They're weak at their number two safety spot, so he's a big stabilizer. I would be for Benjamin sitting down on the concept of sitting a receiver down. They've gone more three wide this season than last year. Last year they were a lot of two tight end or two back, and their running game has taken a beating because of
yeah.
it. They're not the same offense a year ago, and there's no reason to be. They're playing differently, though, because they have Benjamin, and they feel their best guys are receivers, so they get those guys on the field. But they were better last year as a two-back offense. How about for the other game, how about New Orleans-Tampa Bay? It feels like that's a weird one to put in the lightning round because Tampa Bay is red hot right now. They're going to be the Sunday night game next week, so we'll talk about them. Did you see any of that game at all, Gary?
Yeah, it was it was kind of ugly, but look, it was another great performance by the Bucs defense because even when they gave up a couple plays, I mean, there was nothing easy for the Saints. Saints played without Michael Thomas, so they were slightly shorthanded. But it's really, you know, Breeze threw for 257, and he got picked off three more times. And you know, of that 257, it was a grind. It was a grind for the Saints. And, you know, it wasn't beautiful football by Tampa on the offensive end. But, you know, it was enough to win this one. But let's jump, Do you remember the horse Zippy Chippy, who ran 100 races and never won? And eventually, it was the Finger Lakes racetrack said he's not allowed to race here anymore for the good of the betting public. And I think that's the point we've reached with the Cleveland Browns. I think they should no longer be on the board in Vegas. I think people should no longer be able to put their money on the Browns to win a game this season.
Now, all right, two things. One, that's for the good of the racetrack that he doesn't race there, because if he never wins and you bet against him and you win, and that's good for the betting public. So that's what's going on with the horse. Two, Gary,
people were putting their money on Zippy Chippy because it was like the fun novel thing to do.
Oh, all right, well.
Just like people are betting on the Browns to win against the money line, which is crazy. They're not going to win.
We've been good about the Browns. Oh, come on, everyone's. It's easy to trash a team that hasn't won a game. We knew they were going into rebuilding mode. You and I have been responsible about talking about the Browns all season long and acknowledging that when you put on their film, they still look like a professional team. Now, I haven't seen the RG3's latest
yes.
masterpiece yet, so maybe that'll look different. But the Cleveland Browns have played hard. They've looked well-prepared and organized all season long. They don't have as much talent as their opponents. They're paying a price for that. But that's still a team, Gear, that deserves respect.
Mm.
Nope, not going to give it to him.
I think if you watch today's game, you might think differently. But we can talk about that on Thursday, maybe on the Thursday show.
Browns breakdown. Browns full-fledged breakdown. Dalton's playing.
Well,
you know what?
I do want to talk about Browns quarterback situation going into the future, but we'll get into that another time.
All right.
Well, let's jump off to Washington wins in Philadelphia. This was a up and down game. This is a nice little win. I thought it was nice to see Carson Wentz play well again, just because he's been so up and down the last couple of weeks. But this was Kirk Cousins, a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde performance, a little more than we've seen in the past month or two. But he ends up pulling it out in the end, and they win it on a Chris Thompson 25-yard touchdown run off a toss that I believe was Vinnie Curry was in the backfield and almost intercepted the toss. And next thing you know, Thompson is running around end and going in for the touchdown.
They love Chris Thompson there in D.C., as they should. He's a very good, very, very good third down back. The issue with Philadelphia lately, and I don't know the numbers from this game, but just if you say, why has Philadelphia not been the same team that they were early in the season when they were in contending in the NFC East, the offense has its issues at wide receiver. I think we can see that. But the bigger issue has been third down defense. They have not been good in obvious passing situations on third down, and that's often a sign of a bad pass rush, and that's been the case with them as well. Their pass rush has not been as productive down the stretch in the second half of the year. And that's not surprising, because Brandon Graham's a great player. I truly think that. But he's not a true edge bender or edge burner guy. They don't have a guy that can just explode off the perimeter of the pass rush. And that's something they're going to need to look at this offseason in Philadelphia.
Yeah. And look, Ryan Kerrigan won this one on a he clinched it with his trip sack at the end, which I was just kind of waiting for.
Well, remember he
took over that game the first time they met.
Yeah, I was gonna say, remember his first game? That was Vitae's first NFL game, and that fifth round rookie, I think he is at right tackle for Philadelphia. He has gotten better over the course of the season, but it's too bad he can't rush the passer like Kerrigan. They could move him to defense and do that. They need a Ryan Kerrigan on that defense in Philadelphia.
Yep. Andy, which one of these last two you want to get?
Well, we're kind of dancing around Jets and Niners, and
if you woke up this morning and said, I really wish it was preseason week 4, you were in luck, because this game was going on.
Both of these coaches deserve to be back next year. So we agree on that. Then how about the last game of the group, Minnesota and Jacksonville? And that was a close contest throughout much of the day, and then Minnesota pulled away late.
Yeah, not nice. Mike Zimmer back on the sideline. That was good news. And look, Vikings aren't out of it yet. I still think if you press the reset button and you had the teams play 16 games going forward, I still think the Vikings are the best team in the NFC North. I just think they might have dug too deep a hole.
Well, and the hole is that they've got issues at very specific spots, offensive line, and especially with them offensive tackle. And they don't have a way around it. They've got a bad one in TJ Clemmings, who is forced to be on the field at that spot. And when you have a bad weakness at a reactionary position, a position where that guy has to react to the aggressor, that's trouble. Teams that have bad cornerbacks, teams that have bad offensive tackles, those are the two most important reactionary positions. That's probably why they're some of the more expensive positions in the league. Then teams can go after you. They can attack you very specifically there, and that's been the issue in Minnesota. But it wasn't as much the issue today. They survived it today.
Yeah. All right. And, you know, before we move on, congratulations to Bryce Petty. Leads the comeback overtime win in San Francisco. That was nice for him. I don't think he's any sort of long-term solution, but nice win. That is one more win than I will ever have in the NFL. So
yeah, he does look the part. As a pure thrower of the football, he looks like a quality NFL quarterback, just as a raw throwing talent.
Yeah, little limited with what you can do with your offense with him, though. But on that note,
number 10.
We'll move on to topic number 10. This is the weekly awards. Offensive player of the week. I'm just going to go first and say Le'Veon Bell, because he is the obvious pick. after the monster day, 298 from scrimmage in Buffalo in the snow.
And I'll go Beckham because of the difference he made in that game. I kind of want to go for defensive player. I'm going to go Janoris Jenkins. I'm just giving that away now. I would consider Brandon Carr in that conversation too, even though I'm going Beckham, and Carr's the guy that Beckham beat for the game deciding play in Dallas. Brandon Carr traveled with Beckham all night long, and he did a very nice job. And really it was Barry Church who missed the tackle on the Beckham quick slant. Carr defended that fine. The reason Carr played outside technique on Beckham, allowing him inside, and the reason you do that is out of that coverage against that look, you've got your help inside, and you're counting on those guys to make the tackle. They didn't do it. So Beckham is offensive, and then jump into defense. I'm going to do co-defensive players and do Brandon Carr along with Janoris Jenkins, probably tilting more to Jenkins. He had the slightly better game, and his team won because of that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, that Beckham play, that early one where he beat Carr over the top and ended up dropping it, and Heath cheated all the way up on that play, you just sort of thought like, oh, they're not going to give him that little slant. He's not going to have one of those big catch and runs. They're very, very conscious of that tonight, but that's what they got him on. I'm giving my defensive player to Olivier Vernon. I thought he had a great night going up against Tyron Smith. He, a lot of disruption. I think he didn't end up with a sack. No, he didn't have a sack, but I will give it to him anyway. I thought he was fantastic tonight, even though the stats might not say so.
For my
special teams player of the week
first,
Andy.
Oh, you're going to go first. All right, well, all right.
And
so
I'll give it to Trey Burton.
You know, I was all motivated, and now I'm not, because you jumped ahead. So go ahead.
No, Trey Burton. Well, I feel like we have to build up to yours. But
mine's
I'm going to give mine to Trey Burton, because he stepped in on the long snapper. He ended up long snapping on what at the time was the Eagles go-ahead field goal late. Ended up not being the game winner, but you know, that's a skill that's tough to do.
I listened to our old podcast about a week ago, just kind of some self-scouting, what can we work on, what do we sound like, and I listened all the way through, and I heard myself say that I was going to pick Justin Tucker as my special
every
teams
week,
player of the week, every week. And it took me all of 2 days to forget I said that. but having heard the podcast now, I remember it. So my special teams player of the week, and he will play Monday night, so we don't know how it's going to go, but I'm going Justin Tucker. I realize now he's playing Monday night, but I'm going Justin Tucker of the Ravens.
It's the true look ahead.
There you go.
Justin Tucker wrote in about that, by the way. He was upset that that you reneged on your word.
He sent it to the customer support line at MMQB, did he? Talk back?
he called Matt Barkley and said, do you have the email address? Coach of the week. I'm giving it to Mike Smith out in Tampa. He's doing a great job of that defense. And like I said, it's one thing to shut down Drew Brees. I mean, everything the Saints got today was just such a grind for them. And just nothing was really that open all day for that Saints offense. So
Mike Smith, nice job
with that Tampa D.
Yeah, that Tampa D has looked more comfortable in his scheme, those players individually, each week, and you can tell by how good they're getting in their coverage disguises. They're disguising coverage as well, but still playing with great chemistry and spacing in their zone coverages, which is huge. That's everything. That's everything in that defense, and the fact that they can do it while also disguising is a big plus. I like that pick. I've given it to him a few times, I think, this year, but Steve Spagnuolo went up against a very good offense, one that has seen him already this season. A rookie quarterback who's seen him already this season. And Spagnuolo made Dak Prescott look more like a rookie than ever, doing it without Jason Pierre-Paul, so no natural pass rush on the left side of the defense. And they won through schemed pass rush blitz concepts and pressure tactics. Spagnuolo's had a great, great, great year there. In fact, I'd give him Defensive Coordinator of the Year award, because watching how disciplined they become on defense – week in and week out, it's quite impressive.
That's good news there for the Giants. And Andy, that is the end of our show. We are not going to talk again until the Thursday show, the NFL Look Ahead podcast. Please look out for that. But as for now, thank you as always to our researcher, Jeff Irwin. and to the folks at Digital Media who always make us sound good, specifically Matt Havia, our producer, who has to stay up with us, and Chris Basil, our editor, who has to then stay up even later to edit our complete nonsense. Thank you so much to those guys, and thank you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Honestly, we wouldn't have a show without you guys, because no one would put out a podcast that nobody listens to. So thank you so much. Andy and I would love to hear from you, especially mailbag questions for the Look Ahead show. Twitter, Andy_Benoit or gramling_si. We're also on Facebook. You can email us as well, talkback@themmqb.com. We do love hearing from you. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archive episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including themmqb.com, si.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Thursday.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.